From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Cindy Sain, VOA's diplomatic correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. Welcome, Cindy and Steve. Well, here are the issues. Iran and world powers held what they described as constructive talks on Tuesday in Vienna and agreed to form working groups to discuss the sanctions Washington might lift and the nuclear curbs Tehran might observe as they try to revive a 2015 nuclear deal. We'll look at what's at stake given these are indirect talks. In a Derek Chauvin murder trial, a parade of Minneapolis police officers rejecting Chauvin's actions in restraining George Floyd continued, including a use of force instructor who said officers were coached to stay away from the neck when possible. In U.S. politics, the Senate's parliamentarians suggested this week that the Senate could potentially take an unprecedented step to use a process known as budget reconciliation twice every fiscal year, possibly giving Democrats a chance to move a total of 6 pieces of legislation with just 51 votes before the end of this Congress. And a controversial new election law in the U.S. state of Georgia has led to heated disagreement between Democrats and Republicans over its impact on voting access, especially for African Americans and other minority communities. Major League Baseball has announced it will pull the All-Star game and the league's draft out of Atlanta in response to the new election law, and Black religious and community leaders in Georgia are protesting the voting changes. Well, Cindy, I'll start with you and looking at the Iran-U.S. talks. The United States joined talks in Vienna aimed at reviving the Iran nuclear deal, which the Trump administration abandoned in 2018. But the 6 remaining state parties need to find a way for President Biden to lift the sanctions imposed by his predecessor and for Iran to return to the agreed limits on its nuclear program. Even a U.S. State Department spokesperson, Ned Price, told reporters, "We don't underestimate the scale of the challenges ahead." So, Cindy, what are the challenges President Biden is facing with regard to Iran?
Yes, that's right. There definitely are challenges. And State Department spokesperson Ned Price cautioned not to expect any quick breakthroughs, said that the talks will be hard because they are indirect. The situation there in Vienna is that you have the U.S. team of envoys at one hotel and the Iranian team at a different place. And European and Chinese and Russian diplomats are shuttling back and forth. As you said, there are no direct talks. Iran has declined that so far. But I have to say that so far, the indications that we're getting out have been very positive. Ned Price said that the talks have been businesslike. And Iran's president, Rouhani, said that the talks could open a new chapter, call them a success. And the very fact that the talks are resuming, I think, is the best indicator that they may be getting somewhere. And what they are doing, basically, is they're trying to set up 2 separate working groups. And one group is more or less their task is to try to see which sanctions that the U.S. would be willing to remove from Iran. And the other group is trying to see how Iran, what steps that Iran could take to get back into compliance with the deal as far as their nuclear program. So that's what's going on so far. And I would say cautious optimism. It will be very difficult, but this is all happening under the specter of Iran holding presidential elections on June 18th. And we don't know what will happen, but it could be that there is a more hardline government in place. So I think with the sanctions having had a crippling effect on Iran's economy, there is a very much an interest in Iran to get this nuclear deal, to revive it, and to get some of those sanctions off.
And also, Steve, some world leaders just do not trust Iran. Some countries believe Iran wants nuclear power because it wants to build a nuclear bomb, though Iran denies this. Iranian officials say the nuclear steps the country has taken are reversible. What are your thoughts?
One of the more optimistic things that I've seen is that Iran is actually taking part in the revival of the talks. Something that I saw that the Iranian foreign minister, Zarif, had said earlier is that the entire nuclear deal is non-negotiable because it was fully negotiated. He is putting the onus back on the United States to come back to the talks, come back to the treaty. He said, we need to implement something that we negotiated, and something that I saw him was really interesting. We do not buy the horse twice. They feel that they're in a position of strength. However, because of the sanctions, because the U.S. pulled out, it is not in a position of strength economically. They are hurting under sanctions. They're seeing themselves as being played by both the United States, certainly. And there's not only distrust of the Iranians and what they say and what they do, there's a lot of mistrust about the United States and questions about whether or not the United States, if they do come back to this agreement, whether or not the United States can be trusted to stay in this agreement. And that is something that is being voiced not only by the Iranians, but also by the other co-signers of the agreement, the Russians, the Chinese, and the European Union. So the fact that these talks have restarted and are ongoing, I think, is an optimistic sign for the world. But as Cindy mentioned, and as the State Department spokesman mentioned, don't expect progress to come quickly.
And as U.S. officials say, and as we've just been pointing out, this is just the beginning. There will be much more discussion on the lifting of sanctions on Iran, and we will continue to follow this story and to discuss it. And moving on now to the Derek Chauvin trial. The Minneapolis police chief, Madaria Arredondo, spent more than 2 hours detailing the training his officers must complete and the standards they must comply with. Cindy, how important is his testimony and those of the other officers in determining whether Mr. Chauvin is criminally responsible for George Floyd's death?
Of course, it would seem that the prosecution has called a number of witnesses. There was another a use of force expert who testified on Wednesday, who said that Derek Chauvin had used deadly force at a point in time where he was handcuffed and prone and not resisting, and where no force should have been used. As listeners may know, it would seem that the prosecution's main argument is that Mr. Floyd was suffocated. He died of asphyxia. He was deprived of oxygen, as we have seen in the videos of Chauvin's kneeling on him for 9 minutes. Whereas the defense is arguing that Mr. Floyd died of complications from drug abuse. And so those witnesses have been playing out. But the experts testifying that Chauvin used deadly force was very damaging for him.
Steve, the world is watching this particular trial. World leaders even have commented on this case, including Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Chairman of the AU Commission Musa Mahamat, and Labour leader and head of the UK opposition party Keir Starmer, not to mention the thousands of people around the world protesting police brutality in the wake of this trial. So, Steve, why has this case garnered the attention of the world?
Because of the video is the main reason, because we actually have video of a white police officer kneeling on the neck of a black man who had his hands handcuffed, was on the ground, lying on his stomach. And we have video to see how long and excruciating long those 9 minutes plus were. And the other reason this has gotten so much attention is because of police tactics and because of the United States's history of race relations and police versus African-American, Black, Latino minorities. It's extraordinarily rare to see the number of police officers and police supervisors testifying against one of their own. That blue line of police officers in this case seems to be crumbling. The prosecution is building a methodical case. They used eyewitnesses and first responders to tell their stories during the first week of the trial to explain what those people who were surrounding the incident saw and felt. And now they're bringing in police and policing experts to explain training measures and how the training squares with what the defendant did. The reason the world is looking is because of we are not a police state for sure, but the tactics that have been used by police in various different circumstances over the years, has been seen by many overseas as a bit too heavy-handed, especially when it comes to dealing with people of color. As well, it's being watched to see if the police can be held accountable by its people, especially its people in the United States. The defense does not have to prove anything. The police officer who is being charged in the case does not have to testify. It is the responsibility of the prosecution to prove the charges rather than for the defendant to prove his innocence. So while we are seeing quite a bit of prosecution movements, it's still early in the trial and the defense still has its opportunity to rebut and call its own witnesses to testify whether or not the officer was using proper police procedure.
Right. And also, Cindy, even though the jurors are not seen on TV or on if you're streaming it, they do know that it's being broadcast around the world. So I guess just trying to get inside the head of a juror, how hard is it to stay focused in a trial like this?
To me, just from not having watched all of it, but the bits and parts that I have watched have been riveting. And I watched when Mr. Floyd's girlfriend testified, and she talked about them enjoying going out to eat together and that he was a big man and that he had loved good food and really humanized him in a way, because some critics of all the massive protests that happened in the United States have said, well, he was a drug addict. And he had several encounters with the law. Of course, that has nothing to do with whether or not he should have been asphyxiated or killed, if that's the way it turns out. But I think that that some of the witnesses that I have seen have just reminded this is a man, this is a father, a family person, a human being. And I think that the testimony has been riveting. As Steve said, there are the broader issues of problems of white law officers, you know, being perceived as having a bias or using excessive force against African American and people of color. And I think that's what the world is watching. And as Steve said, to see whether or not if there was, in this case, excessive use of force, whether the officer will be held accountable.
One thing that I will note is the prosecution will have a difficult time overcoming the knowledge, and the defense is making a point of this, that George Floyd, the black man who was killed, had drugs in his system. And the defense is going to try to make the case that it wasn't necessarily the policeman who killed George Floyd, it was the drugs in his system. And that's something that the prosecution has to address and will be addressing in the next few weeks.
So along with the rest of the world, we will continue to watch this intriguing testimony and trial, and we'll keep it in discussion. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll look at two more big issues in the news that have Democrats and Republicans in disagreement. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Cindy Sain, VOA diplomatic correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. In U.S. politics, a big issue on a ruling by the Senate's parliamentarian. Well, the parliamentarian is the Senate's advisor on the interpretation of its rules and procedures. Elizabeth McDonough is the Senate's parliamentarian, and she ruled this past Monday that Democrats can use special budgetary rules to avoid a GOP filibuster on two more pieces of legislation, setting the stage for President Biden's infrastructure agenda to pass in two packages with simple majority votes. So, Steve, what does all of this mean?
Well, never has a Senate parliamentarian been as much in the spotlight as Elizabeth McDonough has been in the last few weeks. Because we can spend another hour or so dissecting the strange and arcane rules of the U.S. Senate. Reconciliation is a way around a rule that protects the rights of the minority, called the filibuster, which means before an issue can come to a vote in the U.S. Senate, there has to be a vote to end debate on the issue. So to end debate, you need 60 votes. And in the 100-member Senate that's evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats, getting to 60 votes is very, very difficult. So instead of trying to overcome this high threshold to just get to a vote, Democrats are using what's called the reconciliation process, which bypasses this filibuster only if what's being voted on connects to the nation's budget, collecting money from taxes and spending that tax money on different projects. Democrats used the reconciliation process to pass nearly $2 trillion of COVID relief, and now they're trying to use it again to pass trillions in spending on infrastructure, stuff like roads and bridges and railroads, which is usually popular with both Republicans and Democrats. But now Republicans say Democrats are trying to go beyond the usual construction projects that infrastructure takes on. So they're largely opposing the legislation. And Democrats themselves are going to have issues getting this legislation just to a vote because they have to satisfy their own people. If you've got 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, now Kamala Harris, the vice president, is the tie-breaking vote. But to get to that tie-breaking vote, you've got to satisfy all the Democrats. So the Democrats are having trouble doing that before they can even get to a vote. So in a long way of saying this is going to be playing out over the next several weeks, perhaps the next several months, as Democrats try to figure out what it is that they want and then try to bring it to votes in both the House of Representatives and then use the reconciliation process in the Senate. It's a long road that we're going to be going down for the next few weeks in trying to get this issue of spending on trying to rebuild America's roads and bridges and other things before it gets passed by Congress.
Thanks for breaking that down, Steve, on this kind of a complicated issue. And Cindy, as Steve pointed out, the Senate Republicans argue that Democrats should not have been allowed to move two separate reconciliation packages with special protections from a filibuster from the same budget resolution. Is this a legitimate argument? And what are the ramifications of the Democrats being able to do this twice?
Basically, the parliamentarian rules, and it would seem, as Steve said, it would seem really arcane and getting into these Senate rules, which are very old, but it is huge simply because the U.S. government is divided, the country is divided, and at the moment, with the political climate being what it is, getting 60 votes to move anything forward is extremely unlikely, no matter how popular the legislation might be. Even the rescue bill, you know, the COVID relief plan, not a single Republican voted for it. So for Democrats, who on the face of it, you would think, okay, they've got President Biden in the White House, they have a majority in the House, and the slimmest of slim majorities in the Senate with a 50-50 even, and the vice president as the tiebreaker. But still, the reality is that they will have a very hard time getting anything passed in the Senate, as Steve explained. So this rule that the parliamentarian just opens up a tiny possibility for Democrats to get this infrastructure bill passed, which I'm also hearing would be about $2 trillion and would address things like high-speed rail, would address things like cities where the pipes are not good, where some children in schools don't have clean drinking water. It could be a very big and transformative piece of legislation. What would seem to be a very technical, thing could make that possible. And so it is a boost for Democrats, even though it's tenuous and they're going to have a lot of work to try to get it passed.
Okay, thanks for that. And we'll just, for the sake of time, move on to our next topic, the new Georgia voting bill. Georgia, as you recall, voted for Joe Biden in the 2020 election, the first time the state has chosen a Democratic presidential candidate in more than 25 years. But Democrats say the new law aims to restrict voting in future elections. And Republicans who control the state's government say it expands access and increases election security. So, Steve, why is this bill so controversial?
The reason it's so controversial is because Republicans in Georgia passed this legislation as a reaction to what happened in November and the claims by President Trump that there was voting fraud in Georgia. Voting fraud has not been found. Republicans in that state, the Republican officials who ran the election, say there was no fraud in Georgia and that it was a very clean election. So the reaction to both limiting access in some areas, expanding access to voting in other areas of Georgia has left certainly the Black community and other minorities and Democrats concerned about whether or not the next election in Georgia will be one where everybody has equal access to getting to the polls. So the reason it's controversial is because it's in reaction to what Democrats say is a lie about the 2020 election, the lie being that there was voter fraud. And so they're trying to stand up and protest against it. And I would expect various different court challenges to this law to go up through the court system.
And also, Cindy, prominent Georgia-based companies such as Coca-Cola and Delta Airlines, they're also protesting the bill. So should companies take sides in political disputes?
That's a good question, and far be it from me to judge on that. But companies are under a lot of pressure, you know, from consumers to take a stand. And President Biden and the White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, has pointed out that this Georgia law that passed is just part of much bigger efforts from Republican state legislatures all over the country to, as what the White House is saying, to suppress votes, to restrict voting, to make it more difficult for voters to vote on things like absentee voting, on things like voting on Sundays, where a lot of Black churches have events and take their, you know, take their people to the polls. The White House press secretary said there are 361 bills to restrict voting in 47 states. So Democrats are pushing back on this and have legislation to protect voting rights, and no problem getting it through the House. But there again, as we just talked about before, it's very unlikely to pass in the Senate.
One comment about whether businesses should be getting involved in politics. They are able to get involved in politics in the United States because most corporations and companies are able to give political contributions to the Republican candidates, Democratic candidates, or either party. So companies, businesses are already involved in politics by giving donations to various different causes.
That's very true. Thanks for pointing that out. And also, the Major League Baseball moved their 2021 All-Star game out of Georgia in protest of the state's new voting laws to Colorado, which is also a state that requires voters to show identification when voting in person.
One of the things about Colorado's voting system is it is almost all done by mail. The state sends out ballots to all of its registered voters, and more than 90% of the vote is done through the mail, although if you do show up in person, you do have to show ID, yes.
Cindy, I'll give you the last word.
Well, one thing that maybe our international audience should understand is that the reason places like Georgia, why these accommodations to make it easier for voters are important is because in certain areas, and mainly minority areas, in areas like Atlanta, where there are a lot of African-American voters, people have been having to wait in really long lines. Some people have waited 9 and 10 hours. And so that is why Democrats are saying anything to ease that, to, you know, let people start voting a month or so before, and let them, if they are waiting in long lines, let them be given a bottle of water or something to eat. We've had a lot of problems in this country for a long time about making it unnecessarily difficult for people to vote, which people in other places in the world sort of scratch their heads about.
So we could do a whole show on this topic alone, but that's all the time we have. And thanks to our panelists, Cindy Sain, VOA diplomatic correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.